It went straight down the middle. Then it started to hook just a wee, wee bit.
All right, Bruce, let's talk a little bit about your major championship record, which was pretty significant. I'll just give you the highlights here for our listeners. Your record major championships, 16 top 10s, 30 top 25s, 51 of 61 cuts made, and that includes 31 straight from 1964 to 1972, where if you throw out your worst finish, which was 65th, the next worst finish was 39th in that stretch of 31 tournaments, and twice you had three top 10 finishes in a row. So all in all, pretty good stretch of golf in the major championships.
Yeah, except for the one thing that one would always like to have, and that's the win. But, you know, I had my chances, just couldn't get it done, that's all.
I was not going to bring that up.
No.
But seriously, you had a great record across all of them, really. Let's start with the Masters. That's generally was the first major of the year. It still is these days. 19 starts. 15 consecutive cuts made, which is tied for ninth on the all-time list. So that's a pretty significant record. Three top fives, five top tens, 10 top 20s. You had your chances.
Yeah, I did. Again, of course, the most vivid memory would be 1968, the year that DiVincenzo and Golby had the mess up with the scorecard. I had a three-shot lead going into 11 on Saturday, and they had that perilous short left pin, and I hit a perfect drive down the middle of the fairway, and I forget exactly what club. I think it was a 6-iron, and I hit it just the way I thought I should hit it, and I was sort of in my mind thinking, well, I think I'm going to get me another three, and it took a bit of a nasty bounce and a kick left and went in the water, and then I went back to the drop zone and put it back in the water again. And when I looked at it, I thought, oh, you know, maybe I can play that. And I went in there and hacked it a couple of times and finally got it out and one putted for an eight. So that was pretty devastating. But, you know, I played good to the clubhouse from there. I birdied 12 and three putted 13 for a par, and parred 14, put it on the green 15, three putted it, and then I birdied 17 and unfortunately bogeyed the last hole that day. But I think after the quad, it was okay, but you know, eventually finished fourth.
Looking back, do you look upon that as sort of your best chance in the Masters?
Yeah, I think so. Probably, if you think about, you know, where it all ended, I think that was my best opportunity. But I had a chance also in 64 when Arnie won. I started three shots behind going the last day, and then birdie 1, 2, and 3 and sort of put myself right in the middle of it. And then I had a long wait at the fourth hole. I hit a beautiful-looking shot in there. You know, one more foot and I think I've got a relatively short putt for a birdie. And then I was playing with Gary and player, and he hit it in the back left and putted it down, because he was further away from the hole than I was. He putted it down about 8 foot past on my line and said, oh, no, well, let me finish, get out of your way. So he knocked that one past the hole and eventually got it in the hole, and I hit a pretty good bunker shot, but a little too far, and end up missing the putt and making bogey. And I sort of struggled from there on the way in, never really sort of got hold of it again. I lost my momentum.
Yeah, I think you're probably standing in the bunker watching him play four shots before right. You were able to play that bunker shot.
Yeah, it was certainly not his fault, but I for as good a bunker player as I was, I knew I had to keep the ball short of the hole coming out of the bunker and didn't, so bad shot.
One question I wanted to ask you, I think I know the answer, but I'm not sure. If you had one do-over, one shot you could execute again of any of the career starts that you had, where would it be?
Oh, I think I'd have to say 11 at at Augusta in 68. Although, like I said before, you know, I thought I hit a pretty good shot. But I guess rather than try to increase your lead, it might have been prudent for me to play a little further right, maybe, instead of hitting it at the flag. I had it going right at the flag, but I suppose with a three-shot lead, you shouldn't be doing that at 11 when you know there's peril at the left-hand side of the flag, but, you know.
So that might be your one do-over, huh?
That'd be it, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you certainly have been in the record books and perhaps will be in the record books for a long time at Augusta as one of only four players that have had an albatross on the golf course.
Isn't that interesting, too, that there are four par fives, there have been only four twos, and they've all been on different holes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sarazen, 35, Devlin in 67.
Jeff Maggart.
Jeff Maggart, right. Yeah. Maggart, I think, was 93.
He was on the 13th hole.
And then Oosthuizen in 2000.
It was 2012.
2012 on two.
On number two, that's right. And I've told you before, but my dad, my brothers, we used to go to the Masters every year back in the 90s just to watch the practice rounds. And of course, we always finished up at the par three. We loved the Wednesday par three. But on Monday and Tuesday, you would find us behind the second green. So we saw hundreds of shots over the years.
Come in and break to the right, especially that back green placement.
Yeah, and you know, I'm sure you went through this when you would play your practice shots and chips and putts to all the known regular
little areas. Yeah.
Yeah, so we saw a lot of guys practice to that area, and so to watch that shot come in on television, you kind of knew where it was going.
Yeah, you had a pretty good eye. It was going to be close.
It was going to have a chance. So that was kind of cool. It's too bad that Louis wasn't able to finish because he was in contention that year, wouldn't he?
Yeah, he was.
But anyway, the other thing of note is, you know, from a stretch from 1964 to 1973, you had the lowest scoring average at the Masters without winning. It was a pretty good stretch of golf for those 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah, I always loved to play there, and I liked the golf course. It was a golf course where you had to be I wouldn't say necessarily a conservative putter, but you had to know when to take a run at it and when not to. The greens at Augusta are very demanding.
How did they putt back then in the 60s, 70s compared to how they're putting today speed-wise?
On a couple of occasions, they putted quicker than what they putt today. I think primarily for a lack of grass, but a couple of years they were just icy, so quick. But you know, today, even though they, you know, I think I heard the other day that they were running about 12 first thing of a morning, but. You know, today's golf, 12's fast, but it's not dangerously quick. You get up in the 13, 5, and 14s where it gets really, really difficult.
Not Oakmont fast.
Yeah. Huh? Yeah, Oakmont is. I went to Oakmont one year when they were running 16, if you can believe that. You could hardly keep her on the green.
I can't imagine how you could in some of the spots.
It's right? just ridiculous.
Yeah. You told an earlier story about being introduced to Mr. Hogan through Robert Von Nida, your first Masters. But after that, I'm sure you had many memorable practice rounds with quite a few of your old friends.
It was a great relationship I had with Mr. Hogan. After that first practice round in 1962, I had a chance at every golf tournament that we played together, which, you know, I mean, it wasn't half the golf tournaments, but when we were in the same tournament, we got to play practice rounds together. And I guess, you know, it's pretty nice to have been able to play that many practice rounds with him.
Yeah, you had at least one practice round match at Augusta, as I recall, where it was you and Mr. Hogan against Arnie and Jack.
Yeah, that's a good memory. I must check with Jack one day about that, but that it's always a nice day when you can take some money out of Jack and Arnie's pocket.
So they were not on the receiving end that day.
They were not on the receiving end, I can assure you.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to the U.S. Open then, which typically was the second major of the year. It still is. 17 starts, 5 top 10s. Best finishes were in 65 and then in 82. We'll talk about both, but in 65, that was at Bellerive, and you tied for 6th. Had a pretty good tournament, that tournament.
Yeah, had a good tournament there. I remember the tournament more from my dear friend Kel Nager. Looked like he had a really good chance to win the golf tournament, and it came down to him and Gary Player in the last few holes, and Gary survived to win the Open.
And that's a good golf course.
Yeah, it was pretty tough. They had it playing pretty tough that year too.
And then the one that certainly I remember, and I remember it because a friend of mine who you know from Secession that was getting married in 1982, and the honeymoon was actually the whole wedding party together. And so you can imagine what the guys did on the Sunday of U.S. Open. We were watching the U.S. Open from Pebble Beach, and that was, of course, the famous one that that everybody remembers, Watson chipping on 17 and then going on to beat Nicklaus. But you were right in the hunt.
Yeah. The one thing that I remember vividly was after leading after 36 holes, I got up on Saturday morning and I picked up the San Francisco Chronicle. And in those days, maybe they still do it today, I don't know, but the sporting section was always done in green paper. And I opened up the green section, and it had obviously had the Open as the, you know, the opening story, and it said, "Old Warhorse leads the Open." So I've become an old warhorse at 44. I did. I had a pretty good chance to win, though, after leading, leading after the second round. I didn't play so good the third round, but the fourth round I was 4 under through 6. And I'd gotten back into the lead, and then parred 7 and 8, which was good. And then I hit a pretty good drive at 9, and it wiggled its way down on the right-hand side of the fairway into the rough, into a horrible line. I made 6. So that really that took my momentum away.
Yeah, yeah. But the good tournament nonetheless, and certainly a big win for Watson over Nicklaus. Nicklaus had won the U.S. Open there, I think, in 1972. And was certainly right there again on Sunday, but Watson's miraculous chip on 17 kind of put him over the top. Let's talk a little bit about the Open Championship. I think for Americans, we probably valued the U.S. Open or the Masters perhaps a little higher back in those days. But as an international player, the Open Championship was a big, big deal. I think bigger than you know what the Masters and the U.S. Open probably was back then.
Yeah, I would say coming from Australia and more sort of in the world outside of the US, it was probably a bigger tournament for us to win. Certainly, from a financial standpoint, it was. It would have been a lot better financially to have won there than I guess even to have won at Augusta. Although, with my fond memories of Augusta, I'd have liked that too. That probably is the one that I would pick as the one I would really have liked to have won because, as we saw this year, Charlie Coody, 50 years since he won, he's been back for 49 champions dinners.
Yeah, and obviously very special to him and to the other winners that are able to assemble. That's a pretty elite group that gets together every year, and there's great stories come out of that room, I'm sure.
I bet there are.
Yeah, yeah. But Open Championships, you had 13 starts. You had 5 top 10s. In 64 through 68, you played the Old Course, Royal Birkdale, Muirfield, Hoylake, Carnoustie. Your best finishes, One I take note of was 1964, where I think that was the year Tony Lima won it.
At the old course.
Yeah, and you finished fifth after sitting third after each of the first three rounds at the old course, yeah?
Yeah, and I could I always said that, you know, you got to be a little bit lucky. And I had a late and early first two rounds. And I can assure you that late and early, the wind blew 25 miles harder than it was, than it did early and late. So I always tell my wife, you know, if I'd have had Lima's tee times, things might have been different. But
and that happens probably at that tournament more so than others, where
yeah,
it does make a difference, doesn't it?
Yeah, the draw makes it stretches over a long period of time from, you know, from early morning till, you know, some of the guys don't finish till 8:30 at night.
Yeah, and if you catch the draw right, maybe it's a mild morning, you get a score in, you post it, and next thing you know, all hell breaks loose with the weather, and who knows, yeah. Huh?
And that that happens when the tide changes. That's when the wind shifts. Many times, I think over the years, you could play the old course and fight the wind going out, and tide will change, and then you fight the wind coming back.
Yeah, yeah. You tied for eighth at Birkdale the next year, 1965. Peter Thompson won there. You had the lead at 36 holes. You were one back after 54. So that was a pretty good tournament. Did you like Royal Birkdale?
I love Royal Birkdale. I think it's a great golf course. That's a golf course that one of my Aussie buddies, Ian Baker Finch, won the Open at, and we're going to get to chat with him in one of our podcasts. So. And I have a great memory there for winning the Carling World Championship, what would be considered today a World Golf Championship. That's a good golf course, Birkdale.
Yeah, I mean, was that the kind of thing with some of these open rota courses where you'd get on that tee and you had a good feeling about particular courses over there?
Yeah, no, I guess because probably played more there in the Open and Muirfield than, say, Hoylake, for instance. I knew those three courses much better than I did Hoylake.
Yeah, yeah. And Birkdale is a big course.
Yeah, it's a very good golf course.
It's a meaty golf course.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You tied for fourth the next year. So, I mean, you're on a pretty good run here, you know, starting in 64. So you tied for fourth in 66. Nicklaus won his first, at the time, British Open then. Was the completion of his first career Grand Slam at Muirfield of that year.
That's a very difficult golf course. You get the win around Muirfield. It's be honest with you, it's easy to shoot 80 around there if the wind blows hard. But it's still a pretty, you know, it's a great linksy golf course. So,
yeah, Muirfield always has just struck me as a straightforward, relatively fair golf course.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to get the quirky bounces that you're going to get at let's say, Sandwich, Royal St. George's.
Right.
Kind of what you see is what you get. But I suppose if the wind's blowing or if they decide they want to narrow those fairways up and grow up that rough.
Grow that rough, yeah. Yeah, of course, you know, most of the Sandbelt golf courses, they're all fairly close to the water. And you get that tide change, that wind sort of changes, you know, easily changes 180 degrees. So it makes scoring much more difficult.
Yeah. So Jack in winning his career Grand Slam, his first career Grand Slam at Muirfield, I guess one of the reasons why perhaps he elected to name his new golf course up in the Columbus area,
yeah.
Muirfield Village. Huh?
Yeah. I think so for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was just, you know, it was just 2 weeks after that tournament, too, I think, that Tony Lima had his accident, huh?
Yeah, that was terrible. As a matter of fact, it was the night of the, I think it was the night of the PGA that we played in Akron. Hmm. And Tony Lima and his wife, Betty, were coming to Australia with my wife and I. I think we talked a little bit about, you know, the Australian side of golf being, you know, hard to make it a real circuit. But every time we got an American player in Australia, you know, created a lot of interest, and he was set to come down, and unfortunately never made it.
Did you know him pretty well, have a chance to play a lot of golf with him over the years?
No, you know, I didn't play a lot of golf with him. I knew him fairly well. He was a very likable guy, you know, Champagne Tony Lima. I know the press loved him because he'd always buy him champagne when he won. But no, he was a good player. He deserved his victory at the Old Course.
Of course, you've talked about in our teaser episode about the story with Lee Trevino at Royal Lytham, where you shared drivers, which people have now, a lot of people have heard that story. They don't quite want to believe that one.
Right.
Let's talk about the PGA Championship. 14 starts, one top 10. Best finish was tied for sixth in 1965. I think that's the year Dave Marr won at Laurel Valley.
Yeah, Laurel Valley.
Yeah, yeah. So what's your memories of playing in the PGA Championship?
Well, you know, I guess that was probably my worst set of records in the PGA than anywhere else. But, I really don't know why, but I just never seemed to play very well at the PGA.
Was it the venues at all? I mean, different set of golf courses?
I'll tell you what, maybe it was. It's sort of getting late in the year and, you know, you're wanting to sneak back to Australia for a while and play a couple of golf tournaments on the circuit there. Well, a pretty poor excuse, I suppose, but I didn't play very well in the PGAs.
Yeah, I mean, how many people were logging the kind of miles that you and Bruce Crampton and at some point David Graham were logging to come all the way from Australia, come for several weeks, play the tour, go back to family, come back?
Yeah, that was hard. And, it's not like we were flying at 800 miles an hour getting over and back either. Although, you know, most of my early trips were in the old 707. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Even though it was a jet, it wasn't quite as quick as what they are today.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about golf courses. Let's go back to the Open Championship and just think through the Open Rota courses. Of the current Rota, with the exception of Royal Portrush, which was just added, you probably played them all, I would guess, yeah?
I don't think I played them all, but I played most of them. I must admit, of all of the courses that I have played over there, I always, you know, my first introduction to golf over there was the Old Course back in 1958 when I went over there for the Eisenhower Cup matches, but... You know, they got a lot of nice golf courses. Carnoustie's a nice golf course, difficult. But I think, like I said before, all of them are around water, and the tide and the wind has a huge bearing on how that golf course plays. It can play four or five clubs different from one day to the next.
You probably would have played Troon, I would guess.
I did play Troon, yeah.
In 73.
Yeah.
Turnberry.
I played Turnberry.
You played?
Yeah.
So that covers all the Scottish courses. In England, you played, we talked about Birkdale. We talked about Lytham, Royal St. George's. You must have had at least one Open Championship down there.
I never played Royal St. George's. Okay. No. Okay. No,
and Hoy Lake, you would have played?
I played one at Hoy Lake.
Royal Liverpool.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's really it. I mean, other than Portrush, and then, you know, you've got... the four old golf courses that hosted the Open many, many years ago, but they've been out of the Rota for a long time.
Yeah, they have.
So what about American courses? Let's, I guess either PGA Championship or the U.S. Open. What were some of your favorite venues?
I always enjoyed Pebble. I thought Pebble was, right next to the water, but without the conditions at Pebble, it was a really fun golf course to play, where you could make a pretty good score around there if you weren't fighting, 20 mile an hour winds. Mm-hmm. I must say though, my favorite course is, I know a gentleman by the name of Mike Gonzalez, who's at my favorite golf club, Secession Golf Club down in Beaufort.
We didn't host any tour events, but it's an awful lot of fun to play.
Yeah. That's my That's obviously giving myself a pat on the back as an architect there, but I really love Secession. I think it's a beautiful place, and it's always fun to go play there.
Well, I'll tell our listeners a little story about that, which I think would give everybody an impression of how important Secession is to you. Bruce and I were walking the golf course back in the summer of 2015, I think it was. We were getting ready to do some bunker work. We were going to put in eco bunkers. We'll give a little shout out to our friends, Richard Allen and Cluellen Matthews at Eco Bunker, who did a fabulous job putting these bunkers into Secession. We were the first golf course in the country, maybe in the world, to commit to doing these, the entire golf course with eco bunkers.
Correct.
And obviously it was very important at the time to make sure that we put them in precisely how that you wanted them to go in, because they were going to be there for a while.
Yeah.
And we were walking off the second tee, a little short par three, and we were walking up from the tee to the green. And I made some remark about, Bruce, I think this is the loveliest spot on the golf course. And Bruce put his arm around me. And as if to accent every syllable, he pokes me in the chest. He says, Mike, he says, write this down. And then he points to a little palmetto tree right by the back tee, right on the back of two green. He says, put me right there. And he points that palmetto. And, of course, what he was saying was, when I'm all said and done, that's where I want to be put with my ashes, is right there. So he went on record. It's in our book.
It's in the minutes.
It's in the book. There's no backing away. He shared that with his family and with his friends, and that's kind of where you want to be, isn't it?
Yeah. Go swim with the dolphins that come in there occasionally.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast, on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
They say, whack down the fairway, it went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.